Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
I'm Vernetta Nuruddin. I live here in Atlanta, Georgia, and I'm a former Fulton County Board of Registration and Elections member.
Vernetta is a Democrat and served on the board overseeing the 2020 election. Part of her job was to certify the results in a county that Joe Biden won overwhelmingly. But President Trump's supporters were not happy, refusing to believe he had really lost. And they lashed out at Vernetta. She had never experienced anything like it. Her email inbox filled with hate.
Tick, tick, tick. And that was in the subject line. And then in the body of the email, it was like, not long now. And, you know, just, you're going to burn in hell, filthy pig. And you're going to be tried for treason and, you know, executed, you know, things like that. So it was very uncomfortable for a while.
Vernetta was able to steel herself to the insult, but she fears the 2020 election unleashed something darker and more sinister.
I really believe that, you know, people who work in elections, they just are hardworking people who care about the electoral process, and that this idea that they were all engaged in this statewide conspiracy, I feel, you know, wholeheartedly that it's just untrue. And I hate that, you know, people, especially in Georgia, are going to feel as if, you know, that their vote is taken for granted or thrown away or just not, you know, just not counted, and that it doesn't matter. And that's, I think, the most damaging part of all of this is that people just don't trust the process.
So canvassing elections, you know, I've done it for over 10 years, and it's usually just a ministerial action. You know, I'm just, okay, you know, sort of get the stamp out and vote to approve, and oh, everything's in order.
Bill Gates is a Republican and chair of the Maricopa Board of Supervisors in Arizona.
And so obviously to echo what the official from Fulton County said, yeah, never seen anything like this before. And the day that I certified the election along with my colleagues, I have the numerous text messages that I received from Kelly Ward, the head of the Republican Party. You know, this reason, Bill, you shouldn't certify today because of this, 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 and this.
In the face of pressure from other Republicans, Bill Gates and his colleagues on the board didn't waver in their duty. Bill saw no evidence of fraud. He trusted the process. And Biden was the winner. His party had lost. He could accept the truth.
To me, I've thought about this a lot. And this attempt to undermine democratic elections really tears at the foundation of everything that we take for granted in a free country, right? Whether it's speech, security, it's economic progress. I mean, it's everything. And so that's why we have felt like we've had to speak up in the face of lies because of that very point.
On January 6th, 2021, when President Trump's supporters breached the Capitol, Bill Gates in Arizona watched in horror.
We've always had a peaceful transition of power. And in my opinion, we cannot say that anymore because of January 6th, 2021. It was a clear, blatant attempt by the president who had lost the election fair and square to hold on to power. And the way that he's used other Republicans, used good Americans, right, to try and accomplish this is just chilling.
Chair of the Maricopa County Board of Supervisors in Arizona, Bill Gates. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store, in for Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. And so here we are. It's an election year again. We've just marked the 1-year anniversary of January 6th, and the shadow that was cast over our American electoral process in 2020 now looms much larger. Last year, 19 states passed legislation that restricts access to voting. Congress has stalled on federal election reform, and Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer has promised to do away with the filibuster if the GOP continues to stand in the way of voting rights legislation. There is an urgency to this moment.
If people don't believe in the sanctity of our elections, what is going to happen to this republic? The sanctity of elections, the fairness of elections, the fact that after Election Day we abide by the results has been the cornerstone of our entire democracy. It's what democracy is all about. It's what the founding fathers constructed. Are we going to let that go by the wayside? Are we going to let it be poisoned and vitiated with huge consequences to the effect of this nation, probably greater than any we have seen since the Civil War?
Catherine Clark is the Assistant Speaker of the House and the Democratic Representative from Massachusetts 5th District. Assistant Speaker Clark, welcome to On Point.
It is really good to be with you, Kimberly. Thank you for having me.
So first, I just want to start off by saying yesterday was the one-year remembrance at the Capitol. I think the last time I saw you in person was at the Capitol. It was a difficult day. How are you doing after that remembrance?
You know, I am so glad that I returned to the Capitol 1 year later and heard from my colleagues, from historians, from staff who help care for the Capitol grounds, help us manage the floor, Capitol Police, Metropolitan Police, about their experiences. And it really was a time, as my colleague Lisa Blunt Rochester said, to reflect and to recommit to making sure that our democracy not only survived that day, but continues to survive for the future.
So I want to talk about that urgency that you're talking about of this moment. And first say, it's been a year since January 6th. It's a year into the Biden administration. And we're talking about urgency. But is there a sense on your part at all that this should have been at the top of the agenda starting from day one of the Biden administration and of the current Congress?
Listen, we have many priorities that we have to take on. We have been doing all of these things, putting voting rights, making sure that everyone's right to vote is protected, has been at the top of the priority list, as well as building back better and making sure that we are addressing the devastation to our economy that the pandemic caused, and building back an even more inclusive economy. So we have to make sure that we are doing all these things, because having people have faith in their government, knowing that they are able to vote and vote securely, these are intertwined with how we protect our republic and our democracy going forward.
So you wrote a piece in Newsweek and op-ed this week in which you talk about the two voting rights bills that passed the House but then got nowhere in the Senate, and you're calling for an end to the filibuster. You write, "Our country's future depends on our ability to be honest about the prospects of bipartisanship, the state of the Republican Party, and what we all witnessed on January 6th. But on the Senate side, there has been division within Democrats trying to get legislation passed. What do you expect can be passed, and what's the likelihood that that can happen?
Well, you know, I often think about when we talk about difficult things that we are trying to do, and leading with very slim majorities is difficult. But I think about the last words that my friend and colleague John Lewis shared with us on the last caucus call that he participated in. And he said, "We cannot get weary. We must continue this fight." And so we have slim margins. We are asking people who have long served in the Senate and are used to those rules to reevaluate and look with fresh eyes at where our democracy is and the fragility of it at this moment. And we know that voting rights is where our liberties stem from. And that if we are working to protect that, that unleashes all the positive things we want to do to rebuild our economy, to address climate change, to make sure that we are building a more just and fair country in which everyone can participate. So these are tough times, but this is a Senate rule. And we have to look clear-eyed at where the Republican Party is. They are in the business right now of obstruction and working against our democracy. And we cannot let a Senate rule stand in the way of doing what's right.
So we're going to talk a little later about a New York Times op-ed that made the rounds this week, sort of criticizing that the focus on of Democrats is on what happens before the election, leading up to the election, as opposed to focusing what happens afterwards. Explain what you want to see passed and why that is important for the future of American democracy.
I want to see the bills that the House has already passed make it through the Senate and signed into law. And why it is so crucial, Kimberly, is because we have seen a direct connection between the events of January 6th, where insurgents and the president of the United States encouraging them tried to stop the certification of the vote that the American people had elected Joe Biden. That is taking a sword to our democracy. And what we are looking for in these bills is saying we are going to strengthen the voting rights laws to make sure that people have the right to access the ballot. We are also going to clean up corruption and make sure that the voice of the American people is the one that is listened to in Congress. And what we have seen is very dangerous. We have seen 33 voter suppression laws passed in states around the country. We have seen over 400 bills introduced suppressing the vote. The events of a year ago and these laws are very much tied together. And we have to do everything in our power to protect our democracy.
Okay, that's Assistant Speaker Catherine Clark. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Kimberly.
We're discussing American elections and election reform. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. We're discussing American elections, voting rights, and the way forward with election reform. Joining me now is John Fortier. He's a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, where he focuses on all things elections. He's author and editor of After the People Vote, a guide to the Electoral College. John, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Kimberly.
So I want to start off by talking a bit about the filibuster and those, including Assistant Speaker Clark, who would like to see it eliminated. Republicans are not on board with this plan. What do you think about that?
Well, first, I do think we should properly call out some of the problems of January 6th. Obviously, the violence at the Capitol, and as you mentioned in your earlier segments, violence that is threatened against election officials who, whether you agree with the policies and the vote outcomes, are civil servants trying to do their job and administer elections. You know, I also think that we should be careful about the way in which we know that we need to resolve elections by a certain time. And here, I think we spent too long. As much as there are always issues to argue about and always issues that one side will lose on, there still is a time finite to resolve these elections. And in the presidential election, it's in December, not later in the process. That being said, I do think that we have a couple of different sets of things going on. There are people talking about January 6th, and then there's a much broader voting rights, voting agenda that the Democrats have had since 2018 in a very large bill and in several bills that are slightly slimmed down, but they are bills that are essentially partisan. They have only Democratic support. They really don't have any Republican support. And with their narrow margins, the goal that some see is to persuade Senator Manchin, maybe Senator Sinema, that for these purposes of democracy bills, you should get rid of the filibuster. When we look at how we vote in America, we vote mostly, and the laws that we pass are really mostly at the state level. In some instances, the early voting rights acts and registration reform after the 2000 election, several instances where the parties have come together to pass some national standards. But those are usually things that are more broadly agreed upon, partly because of the filibuster, which causes it to be more consensual. These debates are going to go on at the state level, but I think, you know, we can't all get inside the heads of Senators Manchin and Sinema, but unless they change their stated positions, you know, Democrats won't be able to pass this without changing the filibuster. And I think more appropriately, much of this debate will go on at the state level where there are differences of opinion. There are red states and blue states, but that's where most of our election law is passed.
So I want to get a little bit more in the difference between legislation aimed at what happens after the election versus what happens before the election and the New York Times op-ed by your colleague, Yuval Levin. But first, I want to say you're talking about January 6th, which is important, but voting rights and the need to protect voting rights didn't begin on January 6th, right? And on the federal level, we've had the Voting Rights Act. There are multiple constitutional amendments aimed at protecting the right to vote. So this isn't to say that the need to shore up and protect the Voting Rights Act, some of which are non-functional right now, began on January 6th.
No, I think you're absolutely right. The voting rights provisions more narrowly, but also these broader provisions about election administration and how we run elections and whether we have more vote by mail or campaign finance, all of these things that are in the Democratic reform bills are longstanding issues. And frankly, there are also longstanding differences between the parties. You know, occasionally we have broken through and found, compromises and more consensual agreements, again, after the 2000 election. That was a time that was very tense and one that both parties really fought very closely. And surprisingly, they did come up with a series of reforms, not perfect on either side, but that they were able to pass at the federal level. That's the exception. The more normal course of events and where most of state legislation occurs is at the state level. And that's why we have some differences between the states and the parties probably don't like, the red states don't like what the blue states are doing and vice versa. But, those debates are going on all the time at the state level. And many of the provisions Democrats want to see at the federal level are already in place in many, many blue states. But the question is, can they get it through at the federal level? And generally speaking, doing it with just the votes of one party, especially when you have almost razor thin majority on both houses, mm-hmm. Is difficult.
So I want to get back to Yuval Levin's New York Times piece that made the rounds this week. He says that a narrower set of reforms that could actually solve some of the very real problems with elections in this country and can attract support for from both parties. He talks, among other things, about reforming the Electoral Count Act of 1887. Can you explain a little bit what that is and what you think about that argument?
Well, I think Yuval is right in a number of these areas, and some of this might happen at the state level, but certainly when he mentions the Electoral Count Act, that's something that is a federal responsibility, and that does touch on January 6th. The Electoral Count Act is an act passed over 100 years ago after the 1876 election, which was one of our worst election crises, and it tried to help us better be able to resolve election disputes that not in the states, but ones that get to Congress on January 6th. And it's not a perfect law by many respects. I think there are some changes we could make, small ones like making it harder or having a higher threshold of senators and representatives objecting to the electors. I think maybe more generally, there are principles that we could embrace. One is that the primary running of the elections happens at the state level. Congress doesn't really have a right to go behind the states after the fact and tell them what they did wrong or did right. And then also that that you need to really resolve this. And unless there's some problem that's more with the presidential electors, the Electoral College, Congress's role really isn't there to second guess the states. But I think this is difficult. Even though there are some things that the parties could come around to, it's not something that's going to be passed in a sort of emergency way with a deadline of 2 weeks where we haven't hashed this out. And like most compromises, they're probably a little bit disappointing to both parties. So I think this is an example of something we could work on. I think generally thinking about how states resolve elections, especially presidential elections, where there's a relatively tight time frame, is something that both at the state and federal level is worth talking about, because it's a bit of a black box for voters to see. They voted in November, and then all of the counting and resolving and recounting happens in a way, and then finally we resolve elections. I think that process could be improved dramatically.
So the piece that we're talking about, in it, Yuval Levin broadly makes the case that you have, on the one side, you have Democrats who want fewer constraints to voting, more voting access. On the other side, you have Republicans, many of whom are claiming fraud, who want more safeguards and boundaries around voting. And he writes, if we take both parties' most high-minded arguments at face value, they are worried about problems that barely exist. And then on Twitter, the president of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, Sherrilyn Ifill, took issue with that. She writes, we must not deny the truth that voter suppression schemes create obstacles designed to frustrate voting and drive down turnout among Black, Latino, Asian American, student, and disabled voters. She said that as part of a thread. In the piece, Yuval himself acknowledges that there is zero evidence of election fraud actually happening. Yet we do see laws being passed in more than a dozen states limiting access to voting. And there are studies that show that they affect minorities, poorer people, disproportionately people who are more likely, who may be more likely to vote Democratic. Is there a false equivalence being made here in terms of the not just the high-mindedness of the argument, but in the facts that underlie them?
Well, look, I think there are strong disagreements between the parties about the truth of these things. I don't know if I want to make an exact equivalence, but I do think we're in a very different place than we were 40, 50 years ago, where voter turnout was extremely low in southern states, where African Americans were being formally as well as informally kept from voting. We've made a lot of progress, and that's not to say that some of the reforms we have shouldn't be kept, because it will keep that progress. But we do see very high turnout. I think it is hard to argue that some of the reforms Democrats are calling for will be dramatic changes in turnout because of them. It may make voting more convenient, may make the system better. There are all sorts of reasons why people could be for these reforms. But I'm not sure that our system is holding back a lot of the vote at this point. And again, we're going to have these debates, but very legitimate to say this is the way we want our voting system to look. But I don't think we're talking about a time where some of these changes are going to make huge, huge differences in voter turnout one way or the other. And that's true of the regulation of things that Republicans want or fraud protections. They're probably not as damaging to turnout as people think, but some of the reforms are probably not as helpful to turnout as people think. So all sorts of reasons to hold your views, but I'm not sure that the changes in voter turnout and massive changes that we've seen over the last 40 years are really the types of things we're arguing about today.
Attorney General Merrick Garland spoke on Wednesday to mark the one-year anniversary of the January 6th attack on the Capitol. He vowed to protect American democracy and the right to vote.
We at the Department of Justice will do everything in our power to defend the American people and American democracy. We will defend our democratic institutions from attack. We will protect those who serve the public from violence and threats of violence. We will protect the cornerstone of our democracy, the right to every eligible citizen to cast a vote that counts.
So, John, you have the Attorney General really laying this out as a threat to democracy underway. You heard the assistant speaker really framing the issue in the same way. Do you think that there is a threat to democracy, evidenced not just by January 6th, but other measures? And if so, then what should lawmakers be agreeing upon? What measures would be effective to deal with that?
Well, I do think the first and foremost thing we should worry about is true on January 6th, but has been more true throughout our recent elections, and that is people calling for violence or threatening violence against officials. And that's something that certainly the federal government and the Justice Department, but also state and other local officials can attack. I think we could try to come together a bit more on protecting those officials. It's a little tricky in a sense because we have local officials, we have state officials. It's a federal system where different actors are going to have to police this. But I think that's extremely important. And look, I generally the federal government, again, the Department of Justice has a role in many of these laws that we've passed that are federal. Courts monitor them and allow the Justice Department to go up to the point of the law, but not beyond it. So I do think that focusing on violence and making sure that we discourage that both in our everyday lives, but also use the legal tools to discourage that is very important. The other thing I guess I would point to, which is you mentioned the things that happen after the election. I do think a real focus on resolving elections better at the state level, resolving them more quickly. It's not going to keep every conspiracy theorist from thinking that there's something wrong with elections. But, it is an important part of the process that we often forget. We think of all the things that lead up to when you vote in November. But resolving some of those processes at the state level to just make people more confident that even if you don't agree with all the ways you vote in your state, that they're process is quick and it's efficient and it's also legitimate and gets the process to an end point where you have someone to take office. That's the hope.
Yeah. So efforts that you're talking about aimed focused on post-election administration, but there are measures focused on that that are a part of the Freedom to Vote Act, which was sponsored by a number of Democratic senators, including Joe Manchin. What do you think about that bill? Could that serve as the sort of compromise that we're talking about here moving forward? I mean, it's worth noting that Republicans aren't supporting that either.
Yeah, well, the efforts that Democrats made to negotiate with Joe Manchin this past summer were to alleviate some of his concerns that their original bill was much too broad. And this bill is a slimmed down version of their original set of reforms. I will say it's still a very, very broad set of reforms. Yes, it includes some of the things you mentioned, but it also includes things related to campaign finance and standards on gerrymandering. Not only things that might be hard to agree on between the parties, but also are pretty complex and also have differences that states have worked out in their own ways, which would be overridden by the federal law. So I guess I'm optimistic that if one sat down and worked at it, that there's some things at the federal level, but mostly at the state level that could get done. But I don't think that getting rid of the filibuster and passing something on a moment's notice is likely to be, you know, lead to great legislation, but it's also, you know, contributing to our general differences here. The Republicans certainly could come back and do the same thing when they were in power. And I think that's a real issue, that there's a good thing that most of the federal laws in the past that we've passed have been, you know, somewhat supported by both parties. And I think there's a benefit to that, that there'd be more consensus on issues that really affect the voting booth.
And on that subject of consensus, I want to bring us back to where we started, which is the filibuster. If you look at the Senate's own website and the history of the filibuster, it notes that often it has not been used to foster consensus. It has been used by a minority bloc of the Senate to block legislation, particularly in areas like civil rights and voting rights throughout the past. So is the filibuster a impediment to what you're talking about right now, this need to try to find consensus and bipartisanship?
Well, I think you're right. It's a bit of a double-edged sword. It requires more people to be on board. And in our current system, essentially, it requires at least parts of both parties to be on board and important legislation, not so much on the budget issues, which there are ways around it. But that is good in a sense that it requires, you know, at least a bit of Republican support as well as Democratic support. You're right that there are people who have used in the past, small groups of people who kept things from happening. And so the Senate is going to have to figure out what it wants to do. But it does have this tradition. It's one that I think probably we should at least be cautious about moving towards changing. Over time, we might. But I think it is the stumbling block for a number of issues.
All right. Well, John Fortier is a senior fellow at AEI. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This is On Point.
Three decades ago, Sterling Cuneo was an angry, violent teenager facing life without parole. Today, he's a celebrated author and a peacemaker. His journey is a window into how violence is perpetuated in this country. But it's also a story about how people change.
There's no better example of a person who's prepared to be released.
And about people changing the system.
We have to reimagine what we're doing, because what we're doing isn't working.
This is Cell Blocks to Mountaintops, a podcast and video series. Subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. On Monday, we're talking about wildfires and their increasing threat on cities in the West. In the wake of the fire that burned almost 1,000 homes and over 100 other structures in Boulder County, Colorado, we're asking, are Western cities prepared for a perpetual fire season? Do you live in an urban area that has experienced fires? Are you concerned about how prepared your community is for the threat of the fire season? Tell us your story at 617-353-0683. Today, we're discussing voting rights and election reform and what's next for America as we head into an election year an inch closer to the general election in 2024. I'm joined now by Sophia Lynn Lakin. She's deputy director of the ACLU's Voting Rights Project and assists in the planning, strategy, and supervision of the ACLU's voting rights litigation nationwide. Sophia, thank you so much for taking time with us today.
Hello, Kimberly. Thanks so much for having me on.
So you have heard what Assistant Speaker Catherine Clark said. You've heard my conversation with John Fortier, and you've read, no doubt, the Yuval Levin piece in the New York Times that's entitled "Democrats, Voting Rights Are Not the Problem." What do you see right now, the moment that we're in? How do you see the issue of voting rights and democracy?
Well, I would say that we are living in very perilous times. The threat to democracy is very real. It's a threat that is that must be addressed with bold action urgently. We are seeing attacks that are unprecedented. They are rooted in a long history of attacks on voting rights, but the moment is quite different in many ways, including not only the violence that we saw a year ago, but ongoing, a continuing drumbeat of undermining our election institutions or democratic institutions at every level. The election subversion we're seeing right now, both at the grassroots level and in legislation that we're seeing coming out of the states, is a cause of real concern for voting rights advocates across the board. And anyone who's interested in democracy should be concerned about these things.
So I want to talk about what can be done on a federal level, and also ask you about what we've been talking about all hour, which is the filibuster. On Tuesday, Majority Leader Mitch McConnell responded to Senate Democrats' call to reform the filibuster as a way to get voting rights passed.
The filibuster has been a way to conduct American business in the political center. If you're a football fan, think of it as between the 40-yard lines. Unless either side gets a very large majority, it insists upon moderation and compromise. If you can't reach moderation and compromise on a particular issue, then it doesn't pass. That's been an important part of American history from the very beginning, and all of that's going to be on the line here, all of it, on the line here, apparently, in the next 2 weeks.
So how do you respond to that? I mean, shouldn't voting rights be a bipartisan issue on which there is consensus? I mean, the Voting Rights Act was almost routinely reauthorized with broad bipartisan support. How do you get there? And does getting rid of the filibuster make it harder?
Well, you're exactly right. The idea that voting should be accessible, it should be easy, voters should be treated fairly in the process, this shouldn't be a partisan concern. This very much should be bipartisan. And as you note, it was for a very long time in the years following the enactment of the Voting Rights Act. We saw time and time again legislators coming together in Congress to promote access to the ballot, not just with the Voting Rights Act, which was reauthorized on bipartisan terms time and time again, but with other legislation, for example, the National Voter Registration Act, that increased voter registration in this country quite dramatically. So what we're seeing right now is quite a different turn, and it is very much an obstacle to ensuring that the democracy is what it is, that voters who are eligible to vote are able to access that ballot. The filibuster right now is obviously creating a stumbling block for that, and figuring out how to find a pathway through this particular stumbling block, which I would note has a long history of being used as a way to deny civil rights legislation and movement forward in civil rights throughout history. So it is being weaponized in that way right now as well, and figuring out a way through that is going to be vital to ensuring that our democracy remains strong, that there is comprehensive protections for voters across the country.
So right now, there is partisan opposition to every piece of voting rights legislation that we have seen put forward by both houses of Congress. And one thing that Yuval Levin wrote was that in the face of Republican attacks on claiming election fraud, even though there's no evidence of that, he writes that each party is telling its supporters not to trust our elections unless its favored bills are passed, while implicitly persuading its opponents that those bills are illegitimate and dangerous. The result amounts to an assault on public trust that's worse than any actual problem with American elections. What is your response to that? Do you think that even the fight over the filibuster is creating more partisanship, which in itself is dangerous?
Well, I would push back on the idea that there's some sort of equivalency between the fight to ensure that voters have access to the ballot on equal terms as every other voter, which has been an ongoing fight in this country since its inception. So, and trying to equate that with efforts to continue to suggest that there are ongoing problems in our electoral system, which in recent times has culminated in the big lie that is being used to perpetuate ongoing anti-voter bills. That I would like to push back on in the first instance, that there's some sort of equivalency in those kinds of efforts. And so, you know, the argument around the filibuster obviously right now is I think rooted just in the ongoing battles between the two parties. I'm not sure the fight around it is increasing that level of rhetoric, because that level of rhetoric has existed for quite some time, but it is being folded into a suggestion that that voter fraud, for example, is a real issue that requires some sort of action on the part of election administrators. Today.
So what is it that's being done at the state level that concerns you the most, and what legislation do you think is needed on a federal level to fix it?
Well, there are certainly a number of things. One of the most concerning is the onslaught of voter suppression laws, anti-voter bills, the restrictions on the right to vote that make it much more difficult to vote, that are attacking the very methods that were utilized to great effect, especially in the last election during the pandemic, that allowed voters to be able to access the ballot. We're seeing numerous attacks on that at a level that, at least in recent decades, we certainly have not seen before. On top of that, what we're seeing going into the 2022 legislative session is that we are about to see probably another onslaught of anti-voter bills pushed through once again. And ultimately, the problem is that you cannot deal with these bills across the country in a case-by-case manner. That kind of effort to attack or challenge each of these particular rules — we are involved in a number of litigation — you cannot do that in a comprehensive way. First of all, you're not doing it. You have it at the state level, but you also have it at the local levels that's happening. You need comprehensive legislation that's going to address the kinds of changes that are going to have these rollback effects on voters of color in particular, but other voters, young voters, voters with disabilities, other historically disenfranchised groups. You need to have comprehensive litigation that legislation that prevents these kinds of rules from being enacted in the first place, or at least serves as a deterrent for imposing them in the first instance.
So you're talking about comprehensive legislation. We were talking earlier with Assistant Speaker Clark, who talked about the For the People Act and the John Lewis Voting Rights Act, both of which passed out of the House, both of which went absolutely nowhere in the Senate. On the Senate side, you have a much narrower compromise carved out with Senator Joe Manchin that is probably not as expansive as what you're talking about. So what do you think realistically can pass through Congress right now?
Well, at this point in time, you know, we've had a new call from Senator Schumer to find a path forward. At this point in time, I'm going to continue to believe that there will be a path forward to provide at least some of the protections that we sorely need to protect voters across the country, and not just in particular places. Now, that's not going to prevent, I think, any of the voting rights groups that are working on ensuring that voters are protected at the state level with advocacy reforms there, with efforts on the ground there. It's not going to prevent any groups from continuing to mobilize voters to overcome barriers that are put in place. And it's not going to prevent or deter, stop any voting rights advocates from continuing to meet these challenges through litigation, through every tool in our toolbox. But the reality is that there should be a path forward, and I'm going to remain optimistic that we're going to see something happen until and continue to fight as long as I possibly can.
So you were anticipating my next question, which is, what are alternatives to federal legislative action? You're talking about litigation that is already underway. A lot of times I hear from members of the audience who generally are concerned about protecting democracy, wanting to know what they can do. Can you talk about the alternatives to federal action that you think will be effective in shoring up democracy and making sure that the right to vote is accessible to everyone?
Yes, well, obviously, I've mentioned a number of them. Litigation is certainly one piece of it and is at the heart of what I do. You know, I think another part of this is the redistricting efforts that we're seeing right now, and ensuring that that the maps that are coming out of our state legislatures are fair and are ensuring that voters have equal representation across the board in their state legislatures, which is one of the areas where we're seeing, obviously, some of this anti-voter legislation that I'm talking about, but also other bills and policies that affect every aspect of your lives. So ongoing litigation around that, as well as ongoing advocacy. But that is an important area for individuals who are concerned about the kinds of policies they're seeing coming out of their state houses, their local houses, their local jurisdictions, school boards, county commissions, and so forth, to be engaged in that process and ensure that their voices are heard about what they would like to see and which communities they want to be represented. I think it's also important if individuals are interested in understanding the election process to really do get involved at that local level, to serve as a poll worker, to perhaps even join a local election board, understand how the process works, advocate for changes that will make the system better, and ensure that the duties are carried out properly. I think these are all important and very worthy efforts on the part of all the listeners who are listening today to be a part of. But of course, ultimately also, of course, is you need to go out and vote. I think we hear time and time again, people feeling demoralized by the process, feeling as if their vote doesn't count, as if it doesn't matter, that it will ultimately be pushed away through many of the different systems that seem opaque. And that is a big piece of the puzzle, but they still need to go out and vote.
And you know, we've been talking about January 6th, and you're talking about the work of poll workers and others. That work needs to be protected, and that leads me back to the Electoral Count Act of 1887, which I've talked about way more than I thought I would this week. Do you think that is a part of the solution, fixing the way that votes are certified? Because if the process was different, January 6th may not have happened.
I am open to every possible ways to ensure that our electoral system works and that people feel confident in the system as it is, and that different aspects of it aren't being manipulated for whatever ends that undermine democracy. So to the extent that there needs to be reforms in the Electoral Count Act, then I think that makes some sense. But what does concern me is focusing on the Electoral Count Act or post voting reforms at the expense of the focus on what happens beforehand. The very real, you know, voter suppression is real. It's happening today in an overwhelming fashion. And it really is an affront to democracy and denies people full participation and citizenship in this country. And that really needs to be addressed and not overshadowed.
Sophia Lynn Lakin is deputy director of the ACLU's Voting Rights Project. Sophia, great talking to you today. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken? Wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.